Hey everyone, welcome to the 12th episode of Coffee with Centuro. Good to have Miguel Pereira, who is our guest today. He's the executive president of Darwin Social Noise, which is an advertising agency in Madrid, Spain. Welcome, Miguel.
Thank you, Sarah.
And then we also have Ben, our usual Australian. Based in London. Well, hello there. And I'm Siraj Tofi, and I'm in Cape Town. Zain is not available today, so we're going to kick on without him. So as per the normal format here, Miguel, and you'll get it quite quickly, we just throw out some things we're talking about and we see where it goes. So a story that caught my interest was there's a new electric car brand called Arrival. And I'm not sure they're starting out. They've been around for a while. They've got some investment. What caught my attention is maybe it's just because he wants to be different to Elon Musk. But the founder Denis Sverdlov, he's saying that they're changing their whole perception on the mega factory. So Elon Musk is all about the mega factory, like build the biggest factory that you can and get your economies of scale down. And Denis is saying that he wants to do smaller factories all over the place, almost like a McDonald's place where we will have enough for when you're going. So they've actually started building their factories, one in the UK, one in the United States, but a lot smaller. And a lot more compact and fit for purpose when it comes to that. In this day and age of bigger is better, what's your guys' thoughts on that as an overall concept?
I mean, I'd be quite interested to understand how much of it's going to be automated and so forth as well, right? And are these factories doing everything, or are small factories that do one part of the process, like build the batteries in this factory, then ship it to here?
No, look, they're not that small. They're going to cost $50 million, right?
Yeah.
So he's calling it a micro factory, and each one will be able to produce 10,000 vans and 1,000 buses a year. So it's not small.
Yeah.
It's just not mega.
Yeah, I'm assuming they've obviously run the numbers to figure out where they, you know, does it still work out within an economy of scale. But I mean, we're obviously in an age of diversification and spreading out your assets and so forth. If one mega factory goes down, what's that impact your production? Whereas if you have 10 factories, 15 factories, and one goes down, you've got the others, right? So I think it probably makes sense from that point of view. I'd be really interested to understand if they've figured out, because surely then I don't know, just the multiplying of factories seems like it just must have more costs than one big one, but I suppose it must be costs in having one massive bit of land and so forth as well.
I think it's surprising because that's a sector, that's an industry with very high fixed costs. That you need to break even, you need economies of scale usually. I'm sure, like Ben said, they run their numbers, but I think it's a surprising announcement, that model. I wonder if that will have an impact on the price of the cars, and they look for a different angle in marketing the cars somewhere else other than the price, because having small factories and more factories, like Ben said, it sounds like it's going to be more costly.
Yeah.
At the end of the day.
But surely more expertise distributed around as well. You've got one really good person leading the factory or two in one big factory versus you need 10 really good managers to run 10 factories at 10 high manager salaries and so forth. Again, I'm assuming a bigger factory still needs more people and you know, more high level. Not one person can run a whole mega factory, but yeah. It's interesting, and
again, maybe it's also a lot of media because he's also saying he's going to be able to bring his costs down. So he's going to be the vehicles are going to be a lot more cost effective. They're making it lighter. They're making the battery more efficient. It's a bit early days for him. But my hook here for you, Miguel, is how do you think this similar kind of thinking is changing in the advertising world? Because I think if we look back 10 years ago, there were the massive big ad agencies in every country, right? You had So we're talking about big, big ad agencies that did everything.
Right.
And is that model broken? Because is the big ad agency thing broken? And are we much, much more efficient with the smaller agencies?
Well, I think the model, Sarai, is definitely breaking up because there is, in the last 10 years, we've seen a fragmentation of areas of expertise related to advertising and marketing, which was creating the need for smaller entities, whether it's freelancers or companies, to provide those services. And big companies can't take it all, because taking it all means taking all the risks that come along with having all that expertise in-house. Yeah. So in the last few years, we've seen smaller shops and smaller units of talent popping up everywhere in smaller areas of expertise that yet were very important in the creative process. Yeah. And I think that has made it easier for smaller agencies to break through and have access to clients who are usually only the big multinational, the big flagships would have access to. Right now, I think the issue, the new challenge that comes along with that is that who's going to supervise all these hundreds or thousands of different areas of expertise? So there's this new figure of the, like, you have your main doctor in the family that then refers you to the specialist. You need that figure in the marketing department, whether it's in-house or outsourced. You need someone that oversees the overall strategy, the umbrella strategy, and decides where to put your money and your efforts.
Yeah.
But the model is definitely breaking up and is going through big changes in the advertising industry.
Ben loves it when I tie things together. Tesla's just reported a fifth straight quarter of profits. You know, they're actually really doing well. So maybe that answers the whole question. Until arrival can, they have arrived, and they can kind of say that they've done that, then it's another thing. But Tesla has posted this last quarter profit of $311 million, and that is five quarters in a row in an age where motor manufacturers are really battling as well.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that has to do with the fact that Tesla is more based on back orders. Maybe those are sales that were back ordered from before first quarter, as opposed to other manufacturers that are more on the quarter sort of sales process.
You're right, because the article did say that they've made the profits, but they're struggling to get all the cars out. They can't physically manufacture
that's
them.
That's been his problem for a while, hasn't it? Yeah. Actually meeting the production levels he said he would meet.
But isn't that the fascinating thing is that if you've got a product that's good enough, people just ignore the age, the things of I want it now. They can, if it's really desirable, I'll wait a few months for it because I actually want that vehicle.
Right.
I mean, we've in South Africa. One of my friends have put a deposit down for the first Tesla in South Africa to be one of the first people with a Tesla. But there's no plan to launch here. We don't even can't even have electricity up 24 hours a day. We've got, you know, it's a major problem. Yet people are already putting down, and I think that's got so much to do with the marketing and the product itself is good, but they create the demand. We once again at the club where you're keeping the little rope and stopping people coming in. They're creating the desire.
Yeah, it's. It's a great thing to show for a business, obviously, and especially where startups and so forth start building up a lot of hype before they even get the product out. The only risk there, though, is then actually having to be able to deliver on the hype. So it becomes a risky move when you create all of this demand, can you then supply, especially in a very physical, a hardware-based industry. So obviously when we're talking about marketing and the big guys breaking up, that's in a service industry where a small team can, especially obviously now with technology, which would have brought that about, beforehand, you would have had to know the right people in the newspaper, get your ads in there, the right people at the TV station. Now, any small agency can run your Facebook ads, get you on YouTube, and so forth. Whereas in the hardware space, you know, you still need that economy of scale, as we were saying. So it's more difficult for someone to necessarily maybe distribute that out to little guys. We're not going to have little small car shops, although, you know, where someone just creates 100 cars a year or something, and that's their own brand of car or something. It's a very different space. So it'd be interesting. Obviously, that's part of the pressure has been him, Elon Musk, that is, fulfilling the demand. So it's risky. It's obviously great to show, but...
Where's that point where a new competitor comes in? What was there? We spoke about it last week. Lucid Air is another electric car that's coming out that is looks amazing. They're really scaling quite quickly. I think as soon as he has really good competition, then that's going to become a real problem.
Yeah, especially as you said, if you don't have to wait. If I can go get a Lucid Air or an Arrival before I can get a Tesla, then all of a sudden his dominance in the market obviously drops off. And while he's there trying to fill back orders, I'll just pop down to the Arrival car shop. I mean, there won't be a car shop. That's even that's a bit outdated these days. I'll just buy it online and someone will drive to my door, hopefully.
It'll drive itself.
So, but I think it's interesting that because one definition of marketing that I like is the art of creating desire. And that's exactly what Elon Musk and Tesla are doing. And that's the rationale behind a lot of the products in the luxury industry, for instance. If you go to the car industry, that's the rationale under the Ferraris, when you have to wait 1 year to get your customized Ferrari delivered. And that's the rationale under Kickstarter, for instance, where you put your money on a product that doesn't exist yet, hoping that in a few months down the road, you might get one unit, which you don't know how to work. But you have the desire because you're into that innovative work.
I was trying to think of why the idea of building up too much demand and then not being able to meet the supply came, and it's Kickstarter. I couldn't connect it, and you reminded me. There's a lot of cases of that where people have gone really successful, but then just not had the infrastructure to actually deliver because they didn't expect 5,000 people to buy their product, and they're like, crap, it's me and my mate in my garage. I can't create all this product. And then they fall over and they go and they lose all the money, and all the people are a bit screwed over from the Kickstarter and so forth. So yeah, I think that's what I was connecting.
It is a great segue, but according to the World Economic Forum, by the year 2025, 50% of jobs will be done by robots in factories. We're talking about the loss of 20 million factory jobs. So that's the first thing. It's like that's it. But then there's a counter to that, which is they predict that almost the same amount of jobs will be created because of the technology. And this is the rubber meets the road. Whereas is it just shifting those jobs up the education food chain? Because you're now going from factory workers to more advanced engineers that will be needed. Is it creating even a bigger divide when it comes to the gap between the rich and the poor?
Well, I think this trend is having a huge impact on education all over the world at all levels, at a primary level, college level, because the demand of jobs is obviously changing. The type of jobs is changing dramatically. And there are studies that good news for our profession is that creative jobs are amongst the jobs that will remain demanded, because robots won't be able, at least not so soon, won't be able to replace creativity and creative work. But you're right. I think it's scary. I think it's creating a fracture in between generations at a world level. And it has a huge impact on how we approach education strategy at every country.
Yeah, I think that's probably why we're seeing so many people start to come out and go like, all right, fine, you don't need a college degree. I just need someone who can code and so forth. And obviously, not to keep giving him too much airtime, but Elon Musk has been an advocate of that. It's like, yeah. I don't really care if you have a college degree, because our requirements have moved so far ahead of what a college used to do, that if you went to college 5 years ago, that doesn't matter. If some guy has spent his time learning to code, then he can probably do what I need him to do. I think it's going to shake up, as you said, the education industry well. I imagine it's the same that we've seen in history, maybe just at an accelerated rate, which I think technology does. But I'm sure people who made horseshoes then had to become car mechanics eventually, right? So, and that would have been more technical than blacksmithing a horseshoe, to learn how a motor works and to know the ins and outs of that and so forth. So I think this has happened before, probably we're just not as exposed to it, and probably it's happening at a more accelerated rate. But yeah, I think we're going to have to. And like you said, there's new jobs now. Data, I saw this a little while ago, but two of the most in-demand jobs in the world are nursing and then data analysts / data scientists, because the need for that, people are just now realizing how much data they have and how valuable it is. Every company is going to need a data analyst on their team, or a company doing it for them, like having a third-party marketing firm. So if you want job security in the future, go get into some data analytics. I think it's coming, or like put your kids into it or something, because that's everyone's going to have those in the future.
And what data analytics of the nursing practice, then you've got it, then you're really there, right?
Yeah, so, exactly. So,
but I'm interested, how do you think the fact that it the impact socially on our social dynamics, because what I'm finding as well is back in the day, in my parents' days, they would either do just their high schooling, or even sometimes drop out earlier to start working because they needed to, and then they were independent and married by 21, for example. Yeah. But as the demand for higher skills come in, the longer your kids have to stay at home, right? Yeah. And the more debt you're getting into it. And is it shifting that socially that we just the average age of the person leaving the household is going to be older? And how does that impact on everything else?
Yeah, I think that obviously goes beyond the job requirements. Buying a house back when your parents were turning 21 is very different to me trying to buy a house now, in terms of costs and so forth. And like, there's a lot of scary like graphs and stats of like the percentage of your wage in 1980 that it took to buy a house versus the percentage of, or the multiplier of your wage to buy a house in 80 versus now is like day and night, in terms of how long it would take me to buy a house versus 30, 40 years ago. And that has gone up way higher than wages have gone up and so forth. So you have to get into the higher skill demands. So I think that's why it's ended up happening. It's going to make everyone have to adapt, I think, quite a lot.
I think it also has to do with the culture of each country is very different, even within Europe, for instance. I think Dutch people, on average, they leave their parents' home by 19, 20, 21. I think in Spain it's in their late 20s, even 30. And that's not related to the years of education. It's just a cultural thing. It's related to the economy in a way, but it's mostly social culture, and that is different in every country that we look at.
Yeah, and I think even I read something about in China, because of the one kid policy for a while, and the amount of space available in China, you have multiple generations living in one household. So you have the great grandmother, the grandmother, the mother, the parent, and the one kid, all living in the same house, and that impacts again how the dynamics in the house is, and that's why they got to the stage very quickly where everyone was on a on their own device to watch what the program they wanted, because before that happened, we all had to sit there and watch what great-grandmother wanted, because she's still the one that makes the decision on the TV, and everyone else is going, really,
no,
do I have
not
to watch
TV. It's the TV, because there was no remote control.
Oh, there was no remote. I was the remote. I used to go up there. My dad used to say, change the channel, and it was only two channels anyway. So we went from one to the other. Yeah. In something really not connected at all, but maybe it's still got to do with this changing behavior thing. there's two stories that I saw, and they're linked. But in the US, they are concerned about the buying habits of turkey, right? So Thanksgiving is coming up, and they're wondering, will people still buy turkey? Because you can't get together in big groups for Thanksgiving. So will they not buy turkey at all? Will they buy a duck? Will they buy a chicken? Will they buy something smaller? And there is a multi-million dollar industry for turkeys. And then the other story that's linked to it is that in the UK, there's another turkey problem. And that is that there isn't enough staff, there isn't enough, and this blows my mind, there isn't enough skilled people to slaughter turkeys in the UK, because most of them come from the EU, and there's a lack of, they need 1,000 EU citizens to come into the UK to help slaughter the 9 million turkeys that are sold a year in the UK.
Well, that's an awkward topic, Sarai.
I know it's weird. I know it's weird, but I thought I was going to leave it till the end, but I don't know if there was a thing there. But I think it's fascinating what is changing. Because here you've got the pandemic changing two things. One is the consumer behavior. Will I buy a turkey? And the other one is the staff can't come into the UK because they don't want to be in isolation for 2 weeks waiting to do their job of slaughtering turkeys.
I think surely they have to be assuming numbers are down on sales, right? And I'm imagining this has to go across market as well. So we've obviously got Halloween coming up. If people shouldn't be out walking around handing kids candy all night, then what is the candy industry going to get hit by? Because every household is not going out to buy their, I mean, we don't really do it here, but obviously I'm thinking in the States, where if the stereotypes are correct and they all have a big bowl of candy ready for the kids to come, if every household doesn't need a bowl of candy now, how many households of candy is that they're not going to sell and so forth? So I imagine we'll probably run into a similar situation in different places, but I have to assume that reducing their number, they're like hedging their bet and reducing their numbers of output, because families will still purchase turkeys, right? And some of them will just be like, nope, this is what we do on Thanksgiving, we're having turkey. It'd be rude to have duck, it'd be rude to have chicken. I've still got a family of four between, you know, within the parents and kids and so forth, so we're just going to have a lot of turkey. And yeah, but they have to be planning for the worst. And I guess if you plan for 75% and it turns out there was only a 10% dip, at least you've sold all your 75%, right? I don't know how the math on that works, but it's better to plan low and sell all of it, right? Rather than to try and predict the market.
But that is happening with so many industries, and the pandemic and people staying home. You change your consuming habits, and that has an impact in not just turkey. I mean, this just once a year, but the restaurants, the leisure venues, the everything. I mean, if I have a friend who owns seven restaurants in Madrid, they're suffering like hell. If I tell her this problem about the turkey, she'll go like, "Are you nuts? Turkey is once a year. I suffer this every day because of the pandemic."
Yeah.
So this is terrible, and we have to adjust our mindset on our business models and get used to it.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. What's the business model they have to pivot to? Home delivered turkeys, can you buy half a turkey and get it delivered or something? Maybe that's
kind of how to slaughter turkey videos on YouTube.
Yeah, Or you get a kit sent over with a turkey and a knife and a mask with them. If anything, maybe that's where automation needs to come in.
Exactly.
Get those people out in factories.
One of the industries that was hugely impacted in the lockdown as well was the home gym. So gyms. Fitness, and so I don't know. Do you guys know of Peloton? The bicycle. It's a static bicycle with a screen attached to it, and you link and you join spinning classes remotely.
They're out of stock.
Their stock price has gone up by 458% in the last year. I mean, their stock price graph looks like the coronavirus graph in the UN, in Europe. You know, it just goes, and it just goes straight up. And again, that's also because of this changing behavior. And we're talking about a Peloton bicycle that costs $1,895. That's not cheap. Their stocks have risen, but the story was that they actually have been put on Moody's or one of those that give them ratings of investment downgraded them a little bit, mainly because of running out of stock and delivery problems and kind of distribution issues.
I think there's in a crisis as big as this one, there's always winners and losers. The key is whether that win is sustainable, number one, and whether you're ready and capable of tackling that increased demand and because it may be counterproductive. If you create frustration within your customers, it may, in the long term, maybe even worse. If you have a spike in sales and then you don't deliver and then you go back. I think at the beginning of the pandemic, I got our management team together. And we said, okay, guys, this is really, really bad, and this is really drastic. But I'm sure there is opportunities lying behind this. We have to make an effort to think beyond the crisis, and try to see what businesses, what industries, what sectors are going to be the winners of this, and try to grow to those industries. Well, it wasn't an easy exercise, but one of the clear winners was anything you consume in the household, especially food, because you're going to be locked down for months, literally. So your consumption of food in the household will increase. So those industries have been benefiting from the situation, or anything that is home delivered. Amazon has increased by, I don't know how much, their sales in Spain during the pandemic. There's always winners and losers there.
Yeah. I think what you said, Miguel, is correct in terms of making it sustainable, because the problem would be if Peloton now goes out and sets up a new factory to meet the demand, and then everything opens back up and people go, God, I want to get out of my house and go get an actual bike or go to the gym again, then they're going to have a factory that's unnecessary. So they'd almost be better off staying the course a little bit, maybe, and create letting the demand build up, but create maybe a system of creating a backlog and going, it's a bit more exclusive, but this is when you'll get your bike, and this is we're going to adapt to it in some level. Obviously your investors aren't going to want you to be turning stuff away, but think long term instead of just panicking and trying to counter it. Obviously if you can do it in a right way of just a bit of adaptation, then of course try and fill the demand. But I think you're right, making sure it's sustainable, because I feel like I heard Peloton were a little bit shaky before some of this stuff was happening as well. And so obviously, like I said, some companies have kind of been saved a little bit by this. So I imagine there were food delivery companies who were trying to compete with Uber Eats and so forth, and have maybe had a bit of a bounce back. But again, is it sustainable? It'll also be interesting to see when more competitors start moving to this market. So I've even seen that a popular little side job for people to start doing is setting home gyms up for people. So set up a little company and get the equipment together, and someone will just pay you to basically come and put in some padding, put in the equipment.
That's smart.
I think there'll be lots of people also shifting to this market now and adapting, right? So if you were first one in and you're Peloton and you just happen to be set up in the right way, or you're Zoom, you're the front runner that everyone had to go to you, but now people will start competing, Teams is popping in. So I think they need to take some defensive measures as well, basically, mm-hmm. to help them be sustainable, account for competitors coming into the market. I've seen one of the new things that's popped up is a mirror. I think it's called Mirror. But behind it is like a screen, and it shows you the workout in the mirror itself. So you can watch the person do the workout, and then you can see yourself copy it. And I think that's like $2,500 or something American. So it's up there in that exclusive range. But then that's, again, bringing a different type of home gym experience. So things will start happening in the market. So I think you still need to be wary while you're adapting to this temporary spike. Well, hopefully it's very temporary.
I'm not sure how it is in other countries. I saw some in South Africa. We've got, during the pandemic, a spike in company registrations. So people are registering businesses at a much higher rate than they normally are. And I think it's based on two things. One is their permanent jobs are under threat, so they're kind of having to start their own business or legitimize their side hustle. Then the other thing to it as well is that there a lot of the austerity issue, not the what do you call it, the COVID kind of subsidies and things were for registered companies. You needed to be officially registered. And I think there's also a bit of a spike in that where it'll be interesting to see if, again, of all of these new businesses that are starting out, how many of them are sustainable, how many of them will stick around. Yeah. Miguel, just one quick thing related to Spain here is that the tourism industry was down by 75% this year. You know, and as South Africa, as we approach summer, we really worried that ours will be down as well. We are a big tourism destination for America, UK, Germany, and especially, but also the rest of Europe, and all of those countries are not allowed to fly in here. Are you feeling it within the industry, that the tourism? You've now just had your summer. Are you seeing many businesses that have shut and needing to pivot?
It's been terrible. It's a nightmare in the Spanish economy, because we're very exposed to the tourism. I told you before the conversation, we were the second largest country in the world in terms of receiving visitors. I think we got something like 80 something million visitors last year, right after France. Tourism accounts for about 12% of our GNP. 12%, that's huge. Imagine a drop in 75% in that volume is a direct impact on the economy. It's a huge hit on the economy, especially concentrated in the touristic areas, especially along the coast in Andalusia, Canary Islands. In Canary Islands is way more than 12% the impact on the local economy. So I think the surveys show that after the first outbreak of the pandemic, I think Spain is at least within Europe, the economy that suffered the most the pandemic, that took the hardest impact, and a big reason to that, other than failures in management and other social reasons, is because of the impact of the drop in tourism. It's huge, really sad. And I can imagine it's the same in other countries. I can imagine in France, in Greece, in Turkey, in southern Cape Town. I can imagine the local economy in Cape Town is suffering, and in other countries too. But we're very, very exposed to that in Spain.
On a personal note, my sister, our family's always been in the tourism industry, and she runs what used to be the family business now. And it was bringing in international tourists to South Africa, but in big groups. And she lost all of that this year because just the big groups didn't come. But she has also needed to pivot. And something that we came up with an idea to set up a summer camp locally that we wanted to do 25 years ago, we're actually now doing it this year because we think that a lot of the people who would have traveled internationally will look for something to do with their kids locally. And there might be an upside from that. So that it really is in the same way that you said, you spoke to your management about keeping the eyes open and just looking for these opportunities. Sitting in a corner, sucking your thumb, hoping that it's going to go by is just not an option. It's a constant kind of pivot and take advantage
of it. Yeah, I think that's smart, because that was my question was going to be around, do you think it will bounce back fast or slowly? Because I think companies should start to plan for those sort of, or should be having those discussions, right? So is there a pent-up demand to travel? And just because things open back up, will it happen? So say that tomorrow there's a vaccine and we can all start taking it, and then the countries go, cool, yeah, come back. You were happy to have you. Do you think all of a sudden everyone goes, well, I've not traveled, I've got my money saved up, boom, I'm off to Spain, I'm off to South Africa? Or do you think people are going to be, I'll just wait a little while and see what happens, and then your tourism goes back up, but it doesn't go back up 75%, goes back up 30%, and right. Then have the businesses assume they'll go back to normal and not plan for a slow increase? Or how do you think that will look?
I think it won't be a V-shaped curve, the recovery. I think we won't go back to the levels of last year. I think even before the pandemic, there was a social trend about consciousness on the impact of your traveling. I think I read some data showing that Swedish people, for instance, last year was the first year in the last 20, 30 years where they dropped their travel abroad for summer because of the consciousness about the environment, of consciousness about flying and your carbon
footprint,
etc. So there is a saying in Spain that is, we say it rains on wet surface. The pandemic is only make it worse. But once this is over, I think the mindset of the traveler has changed, and it won't go back up to the previous level. It will recover eventually, and will find other ways to attract tourists and other types of tourism, I'm sure. But for instance, the airline industry has a huge challenge ahead.
Yeah.
Because it's the pandemic plus the environmental issues all together. And it's like a huge thing.
You know, you spoke about the V shape. I've heard a lot of people talk about the K. It's actually a K, which means it's going to go up, but part of people are just going to die. So it's kind of almost writing a K, because there's a big portion of it. It's either you're gonna bounce back or you're gonna die, and that's really what's happening when it comes to that. I'm gonna wrap up with one last thing. It was Warren Buffett's birthday a few weeks ago. He turned 89.
He's got 89. Wow.
Yeah. And he's got six rules. 1, 2, 3, 4. I've only written 5 down. Maybe it's only 5 rules, but he's kind of 5 top rules of life. It's kind of life hacks. His first one is an interesting one. It is marry the right person. Now, I was so amazed
easy, done.
By that. Marry the right person was his first one, and he said it's so important on who you do business with and who you get into bed with, but the most important relationship is your partner. So marry the right person. And it's something that I wouldn't have imagined from a business kind of guru from that perspective. And then the others, just very briefly, invest in yourself, associate yourself with the higher grade people. So surround yourself with successful people, work with people you respect, which I think is so important. And then ignore the noise. And it's just to, I just,
I like him.
To try and ignore that. And I think it's really, it's all of them are gems, but I just thought it's interesting that his first one was marry the right person.
Yeah. Well, how do you know before you do it is the question.
Someone go ask him. Yeah. Don't worry about the other four. Just tell us. What is right?
I heard this, I'm sure it's not true, this story about when Sony bought Columbia, the movie distributor.
Yeah.
And there were the managers of Columbia were showing the Japanese the figures of the blockbusters, and they said, look, out of 10 big movies you produce, only one is successful, and 4 break even, and then the other 5 are failures. That's the movie industry. So the Japanese, they met and they came around and said, okay, from now on, we're only going to produce the 5 that are successful. The other 5 are not.
Yeah.
The same with the wife. I mean, how do you do it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Then you have the argument that the wrong wife might have been right for you at that time. And makes you who you are after it and all sorts. So,
you know, he's how's this? Because that's his top one, and then it says, oh, he's been happily married with his wife for the last 13 years. I was like, dude, you turned 89. So is this like you only married for 13 years? I wonder that something's not matching up here. Or he's learned so hard in the past that he got it right finally 13 years ago.
Or maybe he's saying,
please marry right because I messed it up the first few times.
Or he spent the first 50 years making sure it was the right woman. Yeah,
it's definitely a tip based on experience. That's true.
Yeah, exactly. There was a I saw, and I really will end off with this, but it's no, I'm not going to. It's fine. let's leave it right there. Let's leave it right there, guys. Thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Thank you, Miguel, for joining
it's been
us.
Fun. Ben, I like the one.
Yeah, I think we just have a little bit of fun. So for everyone watching or listening, because it's a podcast as well, wherever you are, please leave us a message. Say hi. Tell us who you want to chat to, the kind of topics you cover. Give us a share. Give us a like. And again, thanks very much for watching. Cheers, everyone. Bye.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.